Now, for something completely different, here is your host, former New York City radio star, now relegated to third-tier podcasting, Brian Wilson.
Well, ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls, people of all sexes, and those of you who are still on a first-name basis with Bartles and James, I'm once again for something completely different. Living up to our name, today we're going to leave the slings and arrows of outrageous politics in Joe Brandon's garage for a while and stomp on a few grapes. Some of you may remember Wine Time, Fridays on my afternoon talk shows when my friend, the late Professor Walter E. Williams, and I would chat about issues of the day while comparing the wines that we had selected for the occasion. Walter was a big Chardonnay and Pinot Noir fan, while Walter moved on to a better place 3 years ago. Fortunate to have on my speed dial one of the world's foremost wine makers, whom I met back in the days when I was haunting San Francisco radio audiences, and he was working his magic up in the road of Sonoma County. We met at a large wine gathering, Sonoma family get together one evening, chatted on the air a few days later, and the rest is history. From Corbel to Chateau Saint-Jean to his very own Arrowwood Vineyards to Amapola Creek for a total of just about 55 long, hard, grueling years, about the same length of time I was squandering a career in radio, Richard was dazzling taste buds around the world with his award-winning grape juice. Eventually, time came to retire from all that grape stomping and enjoy those golden years we've all heard so much about. But that doesn't mean Richard's left it all in the rearview mirror, the wine industry, the joys of owning a business in the questionable state of California, to keeping a sharp eye and mind on the state of America's state of affairs. Always a great time and opportunity to sip a little wine with Richard Arrowwood. Richard, welcome to the pod.
Thank you, Brian. It's my honor and my pleasure.
I know you're out there scurrying around the Northwest at this time, and it's great to know you've got that great scenery and countryside up there. You know, I'm always kind of interested in what's happening with California wines. It's always been my preferred wine, not to slight the people in France or Australia, South Africa, or Hoboken, New Jersey, but the California has always been the big grape for me, and I'm kind of concerned. I know you've went through it for years and years, decades and decades, actually. But here recently, after all the fires and the recent rains and so on, how are things going generally in the Napa Valley wine viviculture?
Well, I don't know a lot about what's going on in Napa. The old saying is that Sonoma makes great wines, and Napa makes some of the most wonderful auto parts you can get. I'll probably take slings and arrows for that one. But anyway. You know, it's been some difficult times. They've really gone through some tough, tough vintages. And the old saying is, I guess, God protects fools and little children. I'm not a child, so you can kind of figure that one out, Brian. But, at this point, you're going to have to be picky. But there's still, some great winemakers out there, and they can even do it in some difficult times. And boy, I'll tell you, with the fires and then torrential rains and unyielding heat that they took last year, from talking to Phil Kateri, who was our viticultural consultant and helped us develop our vineyards at Amapola Creek and Arrowwood Winery, he said that it was, challenging times in 2020, especially. Of course, we went through from 2016, 17, 18, 19. There wasn't one of them that didn't really cause problems. 2019 was my last vintage of making wines, which on a different subject, I guess, but still related. I really do miss winemaking, Brian, I have to tell you. I don't miss the wine business aspect of it, and certainly dealing with the bureaucrats and the people that have no interest in seeing you succeed at what you're trying to do. But I miss the winemaking aspect of it. But I think my wife and I got out of the business just about in time twice. Once when we sold Arrowwood to Robert Mondavi Corporation, which was really 4.5 years for us. We had a 10-year contract, but they were approached by Constellation Brands and made a hostile takeover. So that was done. And then we moved on and decided to build another winery called Amapola Creek that I had to bring my wife into kicking and screaming. I can't tell you the words that she used when I said, "Hey, let's build another winery," and she looked at me. And anyway, she rarely uses the F word, but anyway, it was some interesting times, and we developed another fine little winery, and it was great. But as time went on, we said, "Well, we just keep blowing through cash." I mean, it's one thing. Used to take you 5 to 7 years to develop your brand or less, and we did that with Arrowwood in a very short period of time. But with Amapola Creek, even though I think the wines were some of the best that I had an opportunity to work with over my career, it was just, you know, it was time to say, look, it's there's just too many rules, regulations, and it wasn't so much that the government involved in your winemaking, although we were a certified organic handling winery, and that was fine. But it became obvious that, you know, the taxation was just too much, as you well know, Brian.
Yeah, we keep a finger on the pulse of what's going on in California just because it has such an influence. If it starts on the West Coast, just a matter of time before it blows over to the East Coast and takes over the whole country. But speaking of the winds and stuff, for a moment, just maybe out of just my own selfish interest, I think I told you about a friend of mine who worked in the tasting room down at BV. And he's up on a lot of wines, and including yours and most of the California product. And I was asking him some years ago, maybe 4 or 5 years ago, about a particular bottle. I don't recall specifically what it was right now, but I asked him about the vintage, and he made mention of those years when there were so many fires, and how some of the vintages in those years had been adversely affected by the smoke from those fires. And I had never thought about that. And I'm just curious, is there a one or more years in particular that were the most adversely affected? So if you're going to drop, you know, some serious bucks on a bottle of wine, you might want to avoid that year.
Well, you know, you've got to, I hate to say it, and I know it sounds trite, but you almost have to taste each individual wine to find out. But smoke taint is a true thing that happens. And this fine waxy pellicle coating on the skin of the grape can attract and pick up many of the components in smoke, not many of which, if any, are conducive to quality. So you have to be careful, and it depends on how you were affected. And not every area was hit that way. So you just have to pick and choose. And so it's not, you can't just say, well, don't buy any 18s or 16s or 17s or 19s or 20, whatever it is, because they're all going to be bad. No, that's not true. I think you have to go through and taste. And we were fortunate because many of the clones that Phil Couturi, our viticulturist and consultant, planted for us were the early Antav French clones that are early ripening. And that was so nice because we were able to oftentimes finish. I mean, it was nice that we had everything buttoned up and I could sneak off to the Pacific Northwest and hunt grouse and pheasant, you know, before the season was done. And it was great. And other people would continue for better than another month. But it wasn't that we were picking fruit at low sugars. We were picking them at full physiological maturity, and it was perfect. And those clones worked well. So we managed to, and I know it sounds like a cop-out, but we managed in those vintages we didn't have any problems. And, you know, there's some remedies they talk about where they can process and remove, you know, some of the materials that can be there from smoke. And I don't want to go into the organic chemistry of it, but there's a lot of what we call heterocyclic compounds that are there that have that really funny taste to it and smell, obviously, during fermentation, because especially with red grapes, not as much as with whites, because generally you can press the whites out away from their skins and get the juice out and ferment it, and you'll be okay most of the time. With red grapes, of course, you've got to ferment on the skins to extract the colors. And those smoke taint will remain. Now, as I said, there's a few people that say, well, they can run it through different processes to take it out. The problem is the more you deal with a product as labile as wine, the more you do to it, the more you take away from it. You can't help it.
Would it be, say, like those of us, out here in the hinterland that don't have a tasting room every 0.6 mile to go in and bang against all the different vineyards and what they got out there? Would it be safe, if not maybe a little cynical, to look at pick five of your favorite cabs of five of the same year? Would it be safe to say that the lowest price of those five, figuring they're all quality bottles, would be lower because the bottler knew for a fact that his wine may not stand up to the other four?
Well, that's a fair assessment. However, I think what happens and what we would have done, and we were fully prepared to do it as we started to assess each vintage. But as I mentioned, we managed to harvest almost everything before anything came in. But if we had a concern that there was smoke in the atmosphere and things, we would separate those grapes out that particular lot. And then if it didn't meet standards, although we never had that problem, we would sell it in bulk. And I'm sure the best producers are not going to put their top label, their best label, on a wine that has got flaws like that. And I would just think that would be just like shooting yourself in the foot. And that's just not what you would normally expect them to do. So if you picked five of the top producers, you may have to pay the money for them. I mean, of course, that's what it is. But because their products, they may have declassified half or more of them, if necessary, mm-hmm. to get the quality they were looking for, and to sort out those lots that may not be correct and may have the taint to it. But again, if you bulk it out and it had some problems, people would still they would taste it, the people buying it, and then they decide whether they want to run it through processes that would remove it, also taking out some of the quality of that product in addition to the smoke taint.
Yeah, well, that certainly explains my last case of Two Buck Chuck, I can tell you right there. That
that could be a
wonder
problem.
What was going on there. But it's good to know. Moving on to some of the other areas of the business and in and out of the business, there's an article from the New York Times, and there isn't all that much that matters from the New York Times, but it was written by a fellow named Eric Asimov. The American wine industry has an old people problem. And this guy apparently spent some time with a guy named Robert McMillan, whom you may or may not know, executive VP of Silicon Valley Bank in Santa Clara.
Boy, I know that. Yeah, I know. Yeah. He's written quite a bit of stuff about the wine business. Yes, I know of him. Good. I don't know him personally, but I've read his stuff. Yeah.
Well, he's essentially saying that the wine industry is in deep fertilizer because the wine industry hasn't kept up, and that the only growth area of sales and consumption in the wine industry was in the over 60 crowd. Even more, the 70 or 80 crowd was the only one buying it. And that was mainly because the wine industry hadn't done a very good job in trying to pull in younger consumers. That the youngsters, whatever they are, generation Z, X, Y, millennial, who cares? You know, they're all looking at craft beers and craft spirits and other things, hard seltzer, yada yada yada. That the wine industry hasn't done. Do you concur with that?
Unfortunately, yes, I do. I mean, that's one of the problems that we all face. When you're If you put out a product, for instance, at the reserve wines from Arrowwood, the reserve wines that we are wines at Amapola Creek, when you're getting, let's say, $100 plus a bottle for Cabernet Sauvignon, you got to have something that is all but orgasmic. I mean, it's just that's got to be a product that really knocks you off your feet.
And it does, by the way, for those of you out there consuming.
The thing is, you expect. I have been to tastings many times with some of the those days. I was much younger, obviously, but anyway, with the youngsters, oldsters, call it what you want, and tasted wines from some of the greatest producers in the world, and tasting them blind. Jess Jackson was famous for doing this, and of course he put his wines in, and we taste them blind, and by golly, it was more often than not. Many of the wines that he had, because he had several wineries, would come out pretty, if not on top, darn close to it, because he really wanted to show that he was trying to get the best value for money. And I mean, I remember tasting wines that, you know, I thought to myself, boy, I'm sure this couldn't be more than $25-$50 in a bottle. And even that I would be disappointed in, and find out that same wine for a particular producer, I'm not going to tell you what state or what country, but, you know, $600+ a bottle. Are you kidding me? I mean, it was just like, whoa. And yet this happened. So what happens is oftentimes, as you well know, people drink labels. You know, they buy the label, and boy, the label has just got to be what it is. Well, it doesn't always work that way. And I think that this is where the experimentation comes in. But we really did not reach out well for the younger consumers. And I was just as guilty of that. My wife actually was pretty good about trying to work with our sales manager to make sure that we did try to go for that particular section, if you will, of the consuming public. And sometimes, luckily, we did well with it. But more often than not, McMillan's probably right that we probably just hit the mid to older section, and that's where it was. And so now you can get away with that to some extent, producing like we did 5,000 cases a year. But you start to get up 10 times to 100 times or more of that, you're going to have a more difficult time. And it's a tough market. And like you say, they're experimenting. They like the craft beers and so on and so forth. But now a lot of them don't want to even drink beverages with alcohol in it. So, yeah, you know, yeah. I'm just not sure where that's going.
Well, there was a couple of things he pointed out in the article. I kind of raised my eyebrows. You know, not the your typical wine snob, but quoting from his piece here, he says, sales of bottles costing more than $15, roughly what the industry refers to as, quote, premium wines, unquote, did quite well with excellent growth and returns. And I said, hold it. You mean a $17 bottle of wine is a premium bottle of wine? Then what does Arrowwood Reserve come in at? You know, what do you call that?
Well, they call those the ultra premium wines, and he was actually a little off in that, because premium, it was usually popular wines were the $15 to $20 range, and then premium wines were above $20. Again, this is going back several years. Mm-hmm. I've been out of the business since 2020. So it goes back several years. But ultra premium, that was the sweet spot that you were trying for. And, you know, as I said, if you're producing 5,000 cases, you cannot compete in the popular or even the premium marketplace. It just, even if you sold directly to the consumer, cut out the middleman, did not have a distribution set up for that, but sold directly from the winery, you still couldn't do it. I mean, you know, our average cost just to produce, our least expensive wine was between $55 and $65 a case cost.
Well, you know, Richard, as we go through, you know, the wine business, all the vicissitudes of getting the grape grown and stomped and in the bottle and all the rest, in looking at this article and others, some other interesting things that caught my eye, and of course, I'm just your Joe average consumer, but I remember when the controversy, if that was not too overblown, of artificial corks came in, and then that passed, and then the controversy of screw top caps came on, and wine industry seemed to survive that. Now I'm reading, and partially mentioned in that article in the New York Times we were talking about a moment ago, there is a, I don't know whether it's a drive or a move or a suggestion or just a brain fart on somebody's part, you know, to put wine in cans. And I suppose that, you know, if we go back to, as I mentioned at the beginning, you know, we go back to our old friends, Bartles and James, sitting up there on the porch, or Boone's Farm, or Old Rot Gut, or whatever, you know, those ones we drank in college and so on, that were just so good. I guess maybe that would be okay. But I'm wondering if an Arrowwood or a Camus or a Heights or, you know, a Pumpback or any of the rest of those would have... that are all up there in what did you call them? The ultra premium, the mega premium, the Godzilla premium of wines. You know, are they going to play nice inside of an aluminum can?
Well, that, of course, that's the difficulty. Is I would quip a bit is a six pack, you know, at $100 a can, that's a good deal. I mean, we could make some money on that. However, wine being a beverage that has relative decent acidity, you've got a fair amount of tartaric acid and other acids in wine. I mean, you'd play hell with just a pure aluminum can, I would suspect. Now, you can line them. Obviously, they have bag in the box, and that's plastic lined, and that's great. Again, a small ultra premium winery cannot. You're not going to make any money that way. There's just, it's impossible. It costs you more to set up for that than it would be worth it. Even when if you have wines that are going to be, some way affected, whether it's smoke taint or whatever it is, you're better off just bulking it out, taking the hit in the bulk market, and be done with it. But as the more you invest in that, I mean, those are things that you better have a pre-made market for. Now, maybe the youngsters today, that, let's say the 21 to 30 some group, they may experiment with it. And wine has been bottled or has been canned, has been put in cans. Now, I don't know what their liner was, but I can almost assure you that it wouldn't have been simply raw aluminum. There have to be something else there to keep from having a problem. But I think it's you go to the question about, plastic corks. Plastic corks, I think, to most people's taste, if you have a young wine, you're going to consume it within, let's say, a year after bottling or so, probably no problem at all. But once you get into an aging situation, I've bought bottles of, let's say, Argentinian Malbec that have been, most of them are what they call an eglon cork, which is all the cork pieces kind of glued together. And then they have a disc on both ends of the cork, so the wine only touches a pure cork and nothing that has any glue or anything else with it. That should be okay. They're not easy to get out of the bottle. That's the biggest thing. And especially some of the plastic corks are difficult to get out of the bottle. But I would imagine wine being in contact for a long period of time, if you're setting something up to age and it's got a contact with plastic, sooner or later, you're going to extract some of that. The chemistry of wine is complex enough as it is, and then you add something to it that is a polymer of whether it's polyethylene, polycarbonate of some sort, whatever it is, there's going to be some extraction, I would think, over time. I could be wrong on that, but that'd be my guess.
I can't imagine somebody putting out a premium wine, an ultra-premium wine like you have, knowing all that, would be inclined to, stick a artificial cork in there in the first place. I would think that, and I agree with you 100%. I've really bulked up my right arm getting the artificial cork out of some of these bottles. I mean, that's that enough alone to say the hell with that. Give me the screw. Yeah. I'll do that all day long.
Yeah, but, absolutely. Well, it has to do, I think, Brian, with the fact that if you buy, for an ultra-premium wine, you're going to buy, like, for instance, we used a 50 or so millimeter cork, and it's first-class top-end cork. And these are what they call sometimes, they're cosmetically gorgeous corks, and they are damn expensive. I mean, you're looking at between 75 cents and a buck and a half per cork to put that in there. But if you've got a bottle of wine that you're going to ask the consumer to lay out $75, $80, $100 a bottle, so what? You're going to have to put a cork like that in there if you want it to age. The idea of a screw cap, now, they usually have a fairly inert membrane. A lot of them, they talked about putting Teflon in there. Of course, Teflon's fairly expensive, although you could use a Teflon disc. But we purchased many Sauvignon Blancs, for instance, from New Zealand, Marlborough and such. They have screw caps, and the wines are fine, but I'm not aging them for 3 or 4 years. I go out and buy one at the store. If we have a fish dish we want, we get the Sauvignon Blanc, and then we do it, and it turns out great.
On the cork thing, this is probably will probably rank as the dumbest question in the in our conversation. When it comes to corks, you say 75 cents, a dollar, buck and a quarter, whatever a piece. When you order corks, are they all the same size, or do they cut them to your specific measurements? Does it vary from winery to winery, the size of the cork, length or diameter?
You can specify length. Normally, for wines that are going to be consumed fairly early, a 40, 45 millimeter cork would be fine, even a 40. for wines that are going to age 50, 55 millimeter, anywhere in that between is where you're going to go with it. Okay. So you're going to have to pay. But you specify that you specify within those parameters. You can't, for instance, if you said, I want a 52 and a half millimeter cork, they're not going to do it for you. You could do it for you, but you're going to pay, you know, $3 a cork. I mean, it'd be ridiculous. So you go with something that fits, makes some sense out of it. And again, ageability on fine Cabernets, for instance, a fine Pinot Noir, whatever, you probably want a longer cork because it's going to be laid down for a period of time, you would expect. Mm-hmm. But the most important thing with cork, not only the quality of the cork, but it's the treatment of the cork that's really critical. Years ago, when corks were taken off the cork oak, let's say in Portugal, they'd boil them in hot water, and then they'd take them out and they'd bleach them with, you know, hypochlorite, with Clorox-type material. Well, that would occasionally lead to, you get these fungal organisms that are still in the wood itself, and these molds and things that can be there. And if you chlorinate that, occasionally you can produce a compound called tyrene or 4,5-6-trichloranazole. Not important what that is chemically, except what's important about it is so aromatic that you can detect that normally between 1 and 4 parts per trillion. That's 1 in 4 parts with 12 zeros after it. Okay, so I mean, it's almost like the national debt. And so it is, it's very easy to detect this, but this corky taint has that smell of, you know, grandma's old cellar or wet cardboard. And once you get that in wine, there's nothing you can do about it. You're done. Mm-hmm. You're finished. Just dump the wine down the drain because it will never come back.
I think I had some of that once. I was going to give it a 9 millimeter cork right between the label. That's just one time.
Unfortunately, that's
that's great stuff, Richard. I try and keep all that stuff in your head. I guess for the average person, someone who doesn't have a 2-story wine cellar or whatever, but just has maybe a few cases that they keep down there for a special occasion, that the smartest thing to do is to, first of all, due diligence, do your homework, and you find a label that's consistently good, then you stick with it. I mean, you and I have known each other for a few decades. I can honestly say, not to blow smoke, but I can honestly say I never had a bad bottle of Arrowwood wine ever, or Amapola Creek for that matter.
Thank you.
They've all been, and I was back in the mid 80s, early 90s. I mean, I was buying the Merlot and the Cab and by the case, and there was never, at least to my amateur taste buds, there was never any variance, you know, one from the other. If anything, they just got better. You know, they let them sit around for 5 or 6 years, you know, then there might be a noticeable difference. But it's just, you just knew you were going to get a damn good glass of wine when you finally got the cork out of that bottle. And it's, borrowing some of your tact, which I am not famous for, I will not mention, you know, a couple of major vineyards out there that have been colossal disappointments for one reason or another. And maybe I didn't do my homework enough to know that, and it was just one of those things. But anyway, I wanted to get a couple of thoughts from you before we say goodbye, mainly based on the fact that you've been in the business, you've been in the major league portion of the business for so long. And like you say, you travel the country, travel the world, you know, major name in the wine world and so on. And it's not just a matter of making the wines and a product and get it marketed and bring it to market and all the rest, but also the business end of it, the advertising, the marketing, the regulations, the taxes, and all the rest. And without relying too much on our previous conversations and what's in the news, I got to believe that you've got to be pretty happy about being out of the business when I think about what all is going on in the regulatory stratosphere of California, taxes, and so on. It's got to be close to insane.
Yeah, it is, and you feel bad for a lot of your compatriots that you have friendships with. And yeah, I talk to a few winemakers occasionally that we've shared friendship with over the years, and you know, they're all thinking, well, how do I exit from this? Well, of course, now they're talking about, you know, you leave California, they're going to tax you if you leave because you've got to pay more of your fair share, quote unquote, some clown in Washington State was saying that too. If you leave Washington, we want to tax you. I don't know how constitutionally you could do that, but anyway, you think to yourself, you got to be kidding me. This is the problem, and it's so anti-business, and it's a tough one, and you feel bad for the people still stuck. But they're, listen. As I said, Brian, I really do miss winemaking. I just don't miss the business aspect of it. But I miss, even though come September, I can enjoy lay back in the sun or whatever if I want to do it at our other home, wherever. But the point is, I miss that. I really do. I miss the excitement, the tension, all those things, playing raindrop roulette and all the things that goes along with trying to be a winemaking warrior. But it was an interesting 54 plus years and enjoyed most of it.
I guess that's not something you can do on a small scale. Does it really mean, like, I know guys who are making up beer in their garage and having a good time doing it, experimenting with this and that. I'm suspecting that, if you've got, 10 feet of grapevine out in the backyard, that's probably not something you're going to be able to churn out a bottle of wine you can be proud of.
Well, if I did that, my wife says she's got a very dull butter knife, and I don't want to tell you what she wants to do with it. So I have to be very careful. I don't know.
I could, and it doesn't even sound right. Elise Bobbitt.
We're gonna enjoy the fruits of the labor from the bottles we've got, and then pick up a few in the marketplace. But no, I'm not gonna make any more of it. Not at this point. I think I
hear
you. Done
well,
my
I appreciate
job.
What you did make, Richard. We still have a few bottles floating around here, and maybe we'll yank the cork on one of them to celebrate the conversation here this this day. And thanks a whole lot for your wine and your time. Give Elise a big kiss for us, and look forward to our next chat.
We'll do it. Brian, thank you. I'm honored. It was a real pleasure. Thanks for calling.
Appreciate it. Valentine's Day is coming at us like a Cupid's arrow shot from a cannon. And while we're on the subject, that'd be a great opportunity to win the affections of your beloved. You could get a gift wrap bottle of Amapola Creek wine, or if there's still some Arrowwood around, or any good bottle of wine is. Wine's great. Wine is the thing. I mean, there's a time and a place for tequila shooters, but I'm just saying. Oh, and by the way, just FYI, you can order. Directly from the Amapola Creek website, a bottle or three or four, or do what I do, get the handy 50-gallon vat that you can tow to parties and family get-togethers and be the talk of the town. So for Richard Arrowwood, winemaker extraordinaire, albeit retired, Joe Ted, our bus driver and developer of the new 5-day turtleneck diaper, so you only have to change your baby once a week. I shall remain Brian Wilson until a better name comes along. Mark your calendars and warn your friends, something completely different returns when you least expect it. Pull the plug, Joe.